And then I was then taken by the artillery for a journey for about half a mile, and then the officer in charge said, "Well, now you go off now with the, and you in that direction, and you'll come across the infantry who are, we shall be attacking today." This is a mock attack, you see, maneuvers. So off I went, walking for miles and miles, and then down, suddenly I came across a load of soldiers all creeping along amongst bushes and things of this sort, and of course these are the people that I'd got to contact. So I spoke to the, went over and met the officer in charge, told him that who I was and what I was doing, and he said he was expecting me. But he didn't seem to take me very seriously because all I did was just kept walking around with these people who were running from bush to bush for hours and hours. And I learned later, he explained to me that he's sorry that I'd had to travel so far on foot, but they'd been retreating all day from the artillery. The artillery had got the upper hand of the situation and had been retreating. This was very hot now, and we were right out in the bush. We were very short, very low scrub growing, that was all, in the sand. And one of the lads was so sorry to see me walking so far. I remember there was a little donkey, wild donkey there, and, or a donkey. It wasn't wild. Where it came from, I don't know, but he tried to get me to ride on this thing, but it was such a small thing, I just couldn't do this. So I had to just keep walking. And then I showed them how to put up their posts and explained to them why they'd got to do it in an open area so that the aircraft could dive down and pick it up. I did that once, I think, once or twice perhaps during the afternoon. An aircraft came over and they were sort of looking at me and laughing like hell to see me down there, the boys were. They'd come down about 30 or 40 feet above the ground and take the mickey out of me. And then I was told, right, the exercise is now off. You've got to go and find your RA people who are at the top of the hill. And I went up to the top of the hill and couldn't see them anyway, anywhere. But I kept going, and eventually I did find them. And so I had a damn good meal with them. I must say I needed it as well, and I had a damn good feed. And then they said, "Well, now you better get to sleep. We shan't be moving off till the morning." So I got my bedroll, and I decided I was going to find a place well away from where the horses and the guns were and sleep there. I wasn't going to be disturbed, have the same experience as I'd had the night before. So I got my bedroll out and slept. And I woke up next morning. It was still quite dark. And I looked around and I couldn't hear any horses moving about and I couldn't see anything. And when I got up, I found that the RA had gone and left me out there all on my own, not a soul about at all. So and I must confess, I was very worried about this and what the hell am I going to do about it? Well, anyway, I rolled up my bedroll and thought, well, the only thing I can do is to follow the tracks of the guns. So I started to follow the tracks of the guns. And I'd been walking a while, and suddenly round the corner behind some shrub came a bullock cart. And there was the man and two or three women, two women, I think, and two or three children on there. And they got bits and pieces that they were obviously taking to the market. There was vegetables, or not vegetables, but sugar cane or something of that sort. I can remember there was some stuff on there. I believe there were some chickens too, some small fowls. So anyway, I gave this bloke a rupee and stuck my bedroll on the back of his bullock cart. And I walked behind them. And we were walking along like this, so it must have been a couple of 3 hours. And we were approaching Jhansi, obviously. I didn't know this, but we were approaching Jhansi because as we approached Jhansi, there was a lovely avenue of trees. And the guns had decided to do a camouflage exercise and get underneath the trees. And I didn't know this, but my photographic people who were still my flight, my squadron was going to take photographs of them along this avenue to see if they could see the guns underneath the trees as a kind of camouflage exercise. However, when they saw me, they were laughing like hell and had a bit of apology for leaving me out in the ruddy desert, by the way. But they did take my bedroll and tied it on the guns, and off they took me to Jhansi eventually when they finished their camouflage exercise. But it was a tremendous experience because I was all on my own. I couldn't speak Indian language. And the lad with the bullock cart could have been a very anti-British type if he'd wanted to be, but so happened that perhaps my rupee I gave them softened him a bit and allowed me to use his vehicle to take me back to the pick up the RA.
This training exercise that you mentioned, whereby the army put up these messages on this line between two posts, once you'd got the message, how did you deliver it to another army unit?
Oh, it wasn't for the army unit. That was a message for us, that they needed some photographs taken of somewhere or other. The enemy was in a certain position, perhaps. You see, they'd say that we understand from a runner that something is happening over there. Could you get some photographs of it? We can't see it because it's over a brow of a hill or behind something or other. Then we would look at this message. Don't know what it could be. Something like this, shall we say. And we'd study this, and then we'd send out an aeroplane, go over, take some photographs, perhaps 50 or 60 miles away, because they'd get runners coming in with messages to them what was happening at a distance. And then we would take photographs and drop the photographs down to their people to let them see the kind of terrain that they were going to encounter between here and, say, the enemy, which might be 50 miles away. They could see where the hills were, where they'd got to avoid if they were going to not show themselves up as targets, you see. Try to avoid a hill, and they'd go along round it, and that kind of thing. That was the object of the exercise.
The photographs would have to be processed on the ground?
Oh, straight away, yes, and then sent back to them, dropped to them.
And you would collect the photographs and then drop them to the unit?
Yeah, you'd take the photographs, have them processed, put into a canvas bag, and then dropped down to them as soon as you could. And, of course, this exercise was to see that you could speed up and cut down the time limit or the time distance to the minimum so that they would have the stuff as soon as we could get it to them. And then we used to time it and see if we could improve on the timing.
So then they'd drop the canvas bags by a parachute, would they?
No, just drop them. You used to fly over them and sling them overboard. There was no need for a parachute. Well, you'd go down as low as you could get. I used to drop them from perhaps about a couple of 3 yards from to dive right down, you see, right down to the height of the bushes, just sling them over the top when you came to the tent where, or the little group of people who were waiting for them.
You said that you were engaged in training the troops of some Raja or Maharaja.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, this was one of the Maharajas that we were training there. These were Maharaja troops that were out there that the RA and us were doing a combined exercise to train them. We also did some training of some troops in the Maharaja of Patiala's area, same sort of thing that we were doing. Training them for RAF Army cooperation in manoeuvres and that sort of thing.
How did you find the troops of these Maharajas?
I didn't have a lot of contact with them because we never met them except I met this crowd. Otherwise, they'd be on the ground and we'd be perhaps 30, 40 miles away and never see them to talk to. But the crowd that I was with that day were a lovely crowd. I did thoroughly enjoy their company. They were. If we could have spoken the same language, I'm sure we'd have been laughing like hell all day about my experiences and my predicament that I was in, because I was wearing a pair of polished black shoes, for instance, glazed polished black shoes, walking through the desert, and they were laughing like hell at the attire that I was dressed up in. I had no idea, of course, what I was going to do when I got out there. I didn't know I'd got to do this wandering around the desert when they told me to go out and meet the Royal Artillery the previous day. So there was quite a lot of bantering going on and laughing about me.
Can you tell me about some of the stories which you heard, or rumours, which you heard in the barracks? You were telling me that rumours were a very common thing in the barracks. And you told me, for example, about the guards who were supposed to be protecting you shooting tracer bullets.
Oh, this was up in Manzai on the northwest frontier again. I never experienced this, and yet I can remember that we were shot at one night. But the story was going around that we had loyal Indian people guarding our perimeter of our aerodrome, our airfield, and that they were protecting us from the rebels. And yet, whilst they were there protecting us, somehow or other, we were still being fired at night time. And so it was decided that they would withdraw all the... Well, they didn't withdraw, and they took away their bullets when they came in, and then they issued them out with another lot, and they used to have to presumably account for the bullets that were missing. And they decided, instead of issuing them out with the normal bullets, they would issue them out with tracer bullets, because there was a little bit of suspicion as to whether or not these loyal troops were actually responsible for us being fired at. And then the following night, there's a whole load of tracer bullets hit our camp, so it's quite obvious that these people were actually firing on us, although they were, in essence, supposed to be protecting us. And this caught them out as not really being loyal at all, but were using this position to do this. Now, I don't remember any tracer bullets ever hitting my camp, but I can remember us being fired at, having bullets hitting the top of the tents at different times during the night. But this was certainly a story that we heard. But you've got all kinds of rumours going around. There was the rumour about the Gurkhas, for instance, who captured a lot of rebels and didn't want to take them for prisoners. So they said to the rebels, look here, we don't want you. We're on your side with us. We're Indians the same as you are. Although we come from Nepal, we're Indians, and bugger off, we don't want to take you in. So they went off, they started going, they hadn't got about 30 yards, and the Gurkhas then fired and shot the whole lot and reported when they got back that this crowd were resisting arrest and they had no alternative but to shoot them. These kind of rumours were quite rife all over the Northwest Frontier. I couldn't confirm them, but whether they were accurate or not, but certainly they were the stories that we used to get.
You told me that whilst you were in the RAF in India, you used to have a novel method of supplying the men down below with cold water.
Oh, well, yes. When we used to go flying in the hot heat of the summer, because we had no... we had chatties that used to keep the water fairly cool. You remember the old Indian chatty? But what we used to do was make canvas bags and used to tie them all along the side of the aircraft, and of course then flying up at about 10,000 feet, the water would be lovely and cool, quite cold as a matter of fact, and by the time we got down everybody would be at the aeroplane waiting to take their canvas bag that they tied there to for some nice cold water. That's what you're talking about, is it? That's what you mean? Yes, we did this.
Didn't you say you also had a plague of locusts?
Yes, there was a plague of locusts at Mbala. In fact, when we used to go for a little cycle ride, I went for cycle rides, and you'd go cycling along the road, and the whole road was covered with them, and you used to see them squashed underneath your cycle wheels as you went along. And they used to sort of seem to travel across the road and then across onto the land, almost like a blanket kind of thing, and eating up vegetation as they were going along.
You were telling me earlier that the method which the Parsis use for disposing of their dead presented you with certain problems in the RAF.
Well, I had an interesting experience when we were down in Karachi. We used to do our air firing down there. We had an air firing range, and we were coming back from the range one day, and on the right-hand side, as we were flying back to the drone, there was a whole host of black birds. It looked like a black small cloud. And then when we looked on the ground, we saw a tower, and the tower had got a kind of grid inside it. And when we got back to the aerodrome, back to our landing place, I spoke to the pilot about this. We pointed out to each other, obviously, but we couldn't communicate with each other. And he said, that's a Parsi burial ground. And so I said, and I just left it like that. And I spoke to the lads in the billet about this and told them about this. And apparently, the Parsees lay there dead on this grill, and the vultures come along and take all the flesh off the bones, and then the bones, as a result of the heat, bleach and fall through the grate, because that was an entirely different form of burial to we'd ever known about in England. And the general reaction was of revulsion. And although it was a small sector of the Indian population that did this, it had an effect of creating a kind of attitude that the Indians must be substandard people to treat their dead in this way. Although looking back, I suppose it's just as good as our cremations that we do in this country today. But it had a serious effect on the attitude of us as young men to think that that's the way they would dispose of their loved ones, as it were.
And the problem for you in the RAF, as far as flying was concerned, was one of avoiding these places because of collisions, was there?
Well, we used to avoid them as far as collisions are concerned, but when I mentioned it to the squadron leader, the pilot and I, when we went in to give our report, we mentioned this, and he said that under no circumstances must we ever fly over a Parsee burial ground, regardless of whether a funeral was taking place or not, because it's holy ground, and they would... it would be violating their religious laws, and we must always, at all times, avoid these burial grounds, which, of course, we did for that, and, of course, for our own safety regarding the vultures that were hovering around above them.
Was this common for the officers in the RAF to give you instructions that, in general, you should respect the religious customs population?
Yes, it was. Not only the religious customs, also their weddings and things of this sort, not to have anything to do with it because we might unintentionally violate the traditions or attitudes and so on of the Indian peoples, because he said that their customs were so different to ours that what we would think would be a normal thing to do might be a very insulting thing to do to the Indians, and so we had to avoid these kind of things if we could.
You were telling me that you read some books which had some bearing on this question of the European attitude towards Indian social life.
Well, we had a library, and there was a book in there called Mother India. And one person got it out and read it and was horrified by the book and the various things that took place in India regarding the sex life, or their relationships of wives to husbands, their relationships to the Brahmin bull, and it was generally... The person who read it, I can remember very much, was very much disturbed by it. And I think everybody in the squadron took it out after that and read it, and we had lots of discussions about this. And when I went to see my friends, the Roman Catholic friends that are playing bridge, I told them about this book. And they said, well, yes, but may we suggest that you read now Uncle Sham, was the book. And apparently it was a book written by an Indian about American way of life, as a kind of answer to the Indian way of life. And so we all read Uncle Sham then, and we became disgusted with what was happening in America too. But that didn't alter the fact that this helped to create a kind of attitude that the Indians were a lower form of human life than we were because of this particular book that we had read. And this all helped to create a kind of anti-Indian approach, although there was no politics in it. It was a general anti-Indian attitude that they should be so brutal as this book portrayed them to be.
What type of brutalities in particular are you referring to?
We were, of course, we were all young men, and we were mostly concerned about the terrible relationship of family life. The wife, who was nothing more or less than a baby when she was married, and treated as a chattel, completely at the beck and call of the men. She hadn't even chosen her husband, which to us was a terrible thing. We felt that this was all wrong. And then, of course, there was the question of the women throwing themselves onto the funeral pyre after their husbands had died, because the life that they would lead as a widow would be so terrible that they'd rather die than face the consequences of it. And this sort of thing was very disturbing to us as youngsters. One other sport that we used to have was making sand yachts. We used to borrow three wheels from the transport section and make a platform and then put a high mast on it. And when the winds used to come, we used to be able to sail around the landing ground. There's a big open space, and we used to enjoy it. It was just some fun making these, and we used to get terrific speeds up, and we used to have to keel over just the same as you do with a normal sailing yacht. And this was quite interesting release for our energies.
How had you got this idea? Had you heard of other people doing it, or was it an idea of your own?
No, well, there is such a thing as a sail yachting, sand yachting clubs. I think in America they have them along the big beaches along Florida, somewhere like that. We got the idea from somewhere like that, and we made these and used to do it.
Was this at Ambala, was it?
Yeah, Ambala, yes.